Okay, so a couple pieces of business real quick. Make sure you get your prereq form to me by 5 p.m. tomorrow. That's your first homework assignment. Don't lose those points. That'd be kind of stupid. And then look for an email from me. You have another real homework that's due a week from tomorrow. It'll basically be some kind of simple problems, get back up to speed, modeling masses and springs and pendulums and stuff. Chapter one stuff. And then those, homework via PDF. Scan it with your phone or scan it somehow and send it to me. And that way I can post solutions right away. You can check your paper copy against the solutions without waiting for me to get them back to you, basically. Or needing to wait for me to get them back to you. So we're going to continue on chapter one today. Start incorporating some other methods of modeling and incorporating and learning how to model other elements. So we're going to start with that by talking through including viscous damping, which is by far the most common method to model damping. And that's section 1.4 in your book. We've already seen this system once and kind of talked through it, but we'll talk through it in a bit more detail. So this is the one that you will get tired of seeing probably. The mass M, we're going to treat basically as a point mass, but it's connected to ground via a spring of spring constant K. And this is our viscous damper of damping coefficient C. And what we're saying with the wheels is that, hey, we have no friction on that surface. Okay, so I'm going to model this system. Again, we kind of already did this once, but let's go through it again. What steps do I need to take? What should I do first? Free body diagram. Good job. So I have this mass here. What kind of forces do I have acting on it? That's some gravity. Normal force, keeping me from going into the ground. A spring force. And then a damper. And that's pretty much it. What's my next step? Yeah, make some coordinate frame. So I think in this case, we can align our x-axis with what we've labeled as the x-direction for that mass's motion. All right. So what is next? We have to figure out, well, what's that spring force here? K delta, okay. In this case, what's that delta? What's the deflection of the spring? Yeah, so how we've drawn X here, if you see kind of this label this way, you can assume, hey, this guy's setting at its equilibrium length when X is zero, right? And then X is deflection away from that equilibrium. So in this case, that delta is just X. How about the force from the damper? What is it in the general case? Rate of change of that displacement, that length. Well, kind of same argument. In this case, that just becomes Cx. We have those forces. Those guys added up give us what? What's that? Yes, it should. Thank you. Have all those forces. What does it give us? Mr. Newton figured out. There we go. Thank you. Okay. In our case, we're going to ignore that vertical direction. We don't have any motion in that direction. Nothing's happening there. Right? So we really are looking at, we can think about it, if we're being strict about it, that we're looking only in that I direction. So some of our forces, we can get the direction here. So a positive x that way, we get an arrow here. So we have minus kx. Mass, what's the acceleration of this mass? X double dot. And then we can collect kind of all the terms together. And there you have equation of motion for a mass spring damper system with no external forces, no non-conservative external forces acting on it. Okay. So that's my equation of motion. I want to get to the time response. How do I get there? Solve the differential equation. How do I solve a differential equation of this form? Same way. Yeah, same method we did with without damping. I can assume some solution. So we can assume where that A is some coefficient, constant coefficient, not this acceleration. And I take that and plug it into this equation and then solve for what the coefficients A and lambda need to be. So let's do that. Well, those guys, and then we just need to plug in. Take x, x dot, x double dot, based on our assumed solution, plug it into your equation of motion, and then you can collect terms. You get that. What has to happen for that equation to be true and of any interest? Yeah, so we need this term to be zero. And we've assumed no external forces kind of in our modeling part of it, right? So A is not going to be zero. It could be, but then the system's never moving, so trivial solution, right? This guy never goes to zero, so that means this term has to go to zero. Okay. So we need that to be true for this equation to hold. And of course, we could solve that. Minus C plus or minus. Remember the rest of this. Let me get some roots that look like that. 1 over 2m, not C. About that. Well, that's not a very friendly form to work with, right? I mean, last time we saw, hey, that term up there has something to do with the kind of physical properties of that system. It tells us something about the response. Right? This does too, but that's a little bit harder to kind of get some intuition about what these terms really represent as it's written right now. So let's look back at our equation of motion. Well, we see, this kind of property, what this system is going to be doing, really depends on each one of these coefficients, right? And more generally, it depends on kind of their ratios. Right? So I'd like to be able to kind of normalize this and get this into some kind of normalized, more generalizable form. Okay? So what I'm going to say is, hey, take that equation of motion that we have. And divide the thing by m. It's going to give me this. All right. So now we're getting closer to something like we saw before. What is this guy? That's natural frequency squared. So we kind of get back to a place where that natural frequency is based on kind of the ratio of those two terms, not either one of them independently. That term, and I just kind of spaced down to be able to write it a little bit larger. That term ends up being 2 zeta omega n. Omega n is still the natural frequency. What's that zeta? Anybody know? Yeah, damping ratio. So damping ratio. So those are really the two things we need to know about any oscillatory system or any oscillatory mode of a given system. We need to know stuff about its natural frequency, and we need to know stuff about its damping ratio to be able to describe its response, both in the free vibration case and the forced vibration case. Those are two kind of fundamental properties of oscillatory systems that we're going to need to, we'll spend a lot of the semester figuring out and how those, and then from those, how do they affect the responses you're going to see. Okay. The characteristic of this response really kind of divides into regions, if you will, based on what this damping ratio is. Okay? If zeta, our damping ratio, is greater than 1, what do we say about that system? It's overdamped, right? We call it an overdamped system. What does that mean for the response?
It's going to quickly go to the equilibrium.
I might argue with quickly, but it's definitely going to go to the equilibrium in a certain way. Right? And I think you might be thinking quickly in that it's overdamped, it's actually not going to oscillate. So it's a non-oscillatory response. We don't have any oscillation. Okay. We end up with 2 negative real roots. So minus square root. I think I missed a term. Yes, I did. There's an omega n. And with 2 negative real roots. They look like that. If I had an oscillatory system or a flexible system, I had this system. Let me draw it that way. And I displaced it. So vertical axis is displacement of this mass. And we have time on the horizontal axis. And I displaced this guy out over to x naught, initial condition response, and let it go. What's that response look like? Yeah, it's just a decaying down towards that equilibrium. And the equilibrium case we saw here was x is 0. Right? So that decay looks something like that. It's a non-oscillatory response. What's the shape of that decay? Yeah, it's exponential. Right? Goes back to this guy. Right? We assumed an exponential form for that solution. Right? In this case, you get that 2 negative real roots, you have exponential decay. In this case, and the kind of a consequence of that, does it ever actually get back to 0? No, it never does. Right? It takes an infinite amount of time to get to 0 in the kind of pure theoretical case. Okay. When might it be useful or desirable to have an overdamped response? What kind of systems do you think? Bridge, you don't want it to move? Maybe. But we'll see if it does start moving. It has the potential to take a long time to get back to its equilibrium position. Any other ideas? Car suspension. We'll see that coming up. This is actually a very uncomfortable car suspension. Can you displace? What you end up here with high acceleration, which is what we feel. So even though the displacement's kind of nice and smooth back to an equilibrium spot, you're feeling a really high acceleration. And we'll see when we get to chapter 2 kind of what this looks like in the frequency domain to have really high damping. So this is a time response. We'll talk about frequency responses later.
I guess like hydraulic cylinders?
Maybe. Depends on what the application is, right? So basically, if there's any kind of system where oscillation overshoot, right? The system doesn't oscillate, so it's not overshooting either, right? It doesn't come down past zero and then go back, right?
Would there be like a soft closed door? Like,
that's one application I have this in my notes of the examples.
Okay.
Right, so I'm sure everybody here has dealt with a screen door that slams and it bounces against the thing, right? Well, it'd be nice if the door just kind of nicely approached that its door jamb and closed nice and slowly, right? But what it's trying to do is get there quickly and then overshooting, and that overshoot is it slamming into the door frame. So it's kind of soft closed doors, like hatches on cars, right? You'll see particularly nicer cars, right? Kind of an overdamped, nice, slow response to it. Doesn't never overshoots its final position. Right? You also see kind of systems designed for this. This equation of motion, of this form, right? We can write it out explicitly. Equations of motions of that form show up all over the place, not just in mechanical systems. So there's some kind of chemical type processes that you could model something like this. And maybe it's more than one mode of oscillation, but overshooting on a chemical process can be big trouble. So explosions happen for the most part. So there are places where this is kind of useful. Places where it's not. Right, we mentioned the kind of car suspensions. Anytime you want to isolate something from what's a base excitation, which we'll talk a lot about in chapter 2, right, this doesn't give you that isolation. Right, this system's kind of responding quickly and not wanting to move, basically. You also will generally not design a control system to be overdamped. Right, so if I have a robotic arm, I don't want it overdamped ever, because it's slow. Right. Zeta less than one, and then it's applied that zeta is never less than zero. What's that response? What kind of response is that? That's underdamped. Probably can infer that, right? An underdamped response. Does that oscillate? Yes. We end up, in this case, with roots that look like that. The complex conjugate pair of roots in this underdamped case. So let's look at kind of, we're going to pick those, and let's plug them in back over here to what we assumed that solution was going to be, and look at what that means, for what kind of x of t shakes out. All right. So those two roots, we need to do the same thing we did before. You guys recognize, I'll save us some writing if we go ahead and do this. You recognize what that term is? Omega n times square root of 1 minus zeta squared. Nobody? I'm telling Hibbler on you guys. That's our damped natural frequency. You'll see it written, sloppy one, is omega D. So when you have damping, that system in free vibration oscillates at not its natural frequency, but its damped natural frequency when you have damping there. So that, we'll do that, so it'll save us some writing. There's a T. So our response looks like that, which we can, of course, write positive omega D, right? Okay. I can pull out the e to the minus zeta omega n t. And we have that. Okay. Does that look like anything we've seen so far? Maybe on Tuesday. Maybe this part. Yeah, so it looks like the equation, the kind of response, the time response we got if we didn't have any damping. We've just kind of changed out this damped natural frequency for the natural frequency. So that part of this equation describes the kind of oscillatory component of the response. Okay. That first term, e to the minus zeta omega n t, what happens if that goes out to infinity? As t goes to infinity, to the amplitude of that term. Yeah, it goes towards zero. Right, so this defines some kind of decaying towards zero. Right, so this actually defines for us the kind of decay envelope of this response, is how we can think about it. How else could I write that? Same trick we used on Tuesday. Sines and cosines. Right. So we could have that. Right, where we have the same kind of thing. This describes the oscillatory motion of that response. This term out front is a kind of decaying factor, how quickly it's going to decay. And the higher zeta is, as long as it's less than 1, this equation is valid, quicker that's going to damp towards 0. So the response of this guy, T, it's not. So as soon as I say this, now let's say, hey, C is low enough to where my damping ratio is less than 1. We have an underdamped system now. And I displace it out, I go over to this mass, and I pull it out to X naught and let it go. What's that response look like in this case? It's going to be a decaying sine. Right. So it will look something like this. And eventually decays out to zero, towards zero out there. Okay. And what we see is that it's this term that describes actually that. Okay. And We have an exponential decay envelope, plus both sides of that response. Right. That's what this term is describing. That oscillation within that envelope, described by, you know, you can do the complex or the sine cosine if you want. Is with me so far? Making some sense? Make some physical sense, hopefully? Okay, let's look. Rays. Let's come all the way back over here. A regularly occurring segment in our class. Controls review / preview. When we look at this system, look at these guys, we've said, hey, knowing what these roots look like in this differential equation solution tells us a lot about our response. Right? I know I have, hey, in this case, two positive distinct real roots. Well, I know that's going to be an overdamped system. Or if I have two complex conjugate roots, I must conjugate pairs of roots. I know I have an underdamped system. That's really, something should look familiar if we plot this out. If we plot that, context is a little bit different in controls. Shows up in the same place. Okay. If I plot those guys, and I have, let's say, match my colors in the notes, pair of roots that look like that. What do I know about my system? It's overdamped. Okay. Okay. Let's just get rid of those on this plot. We'll try a different place. Kind of response to that? It's underdamped. What else can we pick off just straight from this plot? What is this distance? You can look at the roots and pick it off if you want. Yeah, so that's kind of and zeta omega n, right? That's the real component of those complex conjugate pair of roots. Okay. What is that distance? Yeah, so it's in the positive imaginary direction. So you're looking at, well, over here, yeah, that's just omega d. Here's one for you. What's that length? That length's actually our natural frequency. That angle is theta. And our Nernst ratio based on that angle. So, hopefully you guys drew some pole zero plots and controls. Hopefully you drew some root loci. Root locus is all about pushing these poles to a place where the response is satisfying my system constraints. Okay. In this case, we had just a physical spring and damper. Okay. If I look at a mass, let's look at just a mass. and it has a force on it. Okay? And we're going to say, hey, no friction. Okay? Well, if I look at that and I think about that force, okay, and I want that force, I want to pick that force to be one such that I get my mass, M, it's at position X, to some desired position, XD. I want to drive my system to its desired position. Desired final state is one way to think about it, particularly if you're talking controls. Okay. Well, I might choose to make a mass, make a force, I might say, okay, if XD is really far away from where I am at X, I probably should push on this thing pretty hard. As I get closer, I probably want to push a little bit less. Right? Well, if I look at that, well, that's kind of, hey, F should probably be proportional to the difference between my desired location and my current location. What does that look like in terms of what we were talking about right now, so far as in this class? It's a spring, right? What is this in kind of controls terminology? It's part of a PID. What part? That's the P. This is a proportional controller. My error from my final state, between my desired final state and my current state. And this is my error term, my controller. So I have just some force input that's proportional to the error. That's the P part of a PID controller. Well, what if I have, looking at just everything we just talked about, if I have just proportional control in this system, what happens to it? I heard somebody say, I think. It overshoots. And even more so, what else does it do? It oscillates. How long does it oscillate? Forever. Right? There's nothing dissipating energy in this case. That controller is going to look at that error and push it, behave just like a spring, pushing that thing back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So, hey, we probably need to add some kind of damping thing to that controller. Well, maybe you can do that. And maybe instead of C, I call that KD. Maybe instead of just K, that's KP. Well, what is that term? It's the deep part of my PID controller. It's the derivative term. So now I have a proportional derivative controller trying to push this mass to its desired position. Well, this looks, it looked just like a damper to you. So now, in terms of my controller, I get to pick what KP and KD are. Right? And I get to pick those things, and that moves these poles around, moves these roots around. So I can look, and that's why root locus is a kind of nice visual tool. If I'm increasing KP, how are the roots of that system moving? If I know the location of those roots, I know everything I need to know about the response. So that's, I think, a nice way to think about PID control, particularly the P and D terms. It's basically just a spring and damper between my current state and my desired state. And this kind of even extends up to higher order systems. And you probably see, hopefully, see a little bit of that in controls. All right. Questions about that? What happens if these poles get over to this side of the plot? It's unstable. Yeah, we'll talk, maybe get to a problem. Maybe not, maybe on Tuesday that deals with that. Okay. Questions? All right, let's keep rolling. Okay. Let's talk for a minute about energy. And we'll start maybe in context of a pretty simple system and expand out from there. Have a mass with just a spring attached to kind of a hanger, hanging from the ceiling. We're going to say, hey, X is describing this thing's displacement from equilibrium. And hopefully you remember from Tuesday, that can serve as pretty easy proxy for us for its overall general motion. You can figure out what that equilibrium place is and just know X away from it. And it's at distance when X is zero of H. Or actually, that H can be a function of time, too. So both those guys are functions of time. Okay. What is the total kinetic energy of this system? Okay, let's back up then. What is kinetic energy? Kinetic energy, you're kind of on the right track. Let's answer the backup question first. What's kinetic energy? Yeah, kind of energy of motion, effectively. Okay. And we're going to use, as most folks do, a T to represent kinetic energy. Okay. I heard somebody say, well, hey, that's 1/2 mv squared. Sometimes. Okay. What is it in the general case? The v squared, you're kind of implying there that you have scalar one-dimensional motion. You might need rotational. Let's think first. Let's think about just linear for now. Even for just linear, it's more than 1/2 v squared. If you're doing v squared, what are you missing? Quite. Well, we assume if we have a v squared there, you're thinking scalar, right? Kind of. Is a body confined to just one direction usually? No, right? So there's some vector form of this we need to think about and understand. Okay. So we can write that vector form, and it's effectively 1/2 v squared, but you're looking at vectors instead of scalars in terms of the velocity, where v is that velocity. Or equivalently, you can write it this way, dot product, depending on what notation you want to use. So the point, and again, this is just linear kinetic energy, right? The point we make here is that when you were considering kinetic energy with a system, we have to consider its total kinetic energy. You don't get just to pick off the energy in one direction. Okay. And then if we had rotation, we don't, and for this particular system, we have to consider that component of energy as well. So again, the point there, think about the entire total system energy when we're thinking about energy of system. Okay. Potential energy, we're going to use V. For that capital V, what are the sources of potential energy for this particular system? Yeah, it has some gravitational potential, right? What else? What other source of potential energy do I have here?
Stored energy
in that spring. Okay. So in this case, I may be able to say, hey, that total potential energy, potential from gravity plus potential from the spring. Okay, let's talk first about the gravitational term. What's the potential energy from gravity?
MGH.
What is H? I'm going to kind of help you out by drawing it here. Height above what? Below what? A datum. So implicit in the choice of gravitational potential is you have defined what zero potential energy is. Right? In this case, I said, hey, this thing down here, is my gravity datum. At this height, there's zero potential energy. Okay? I could just as easily put my gravitational data up here. The equation of motion will work out the same way. Right? And I make that explicit point because choosing that, you have a choice of where to put that datum. That can make your problem, at least the math part of the problem, way easier. If you take a second to think about, where do I want zero gravitational potential to be? Right? And in that case, yes, it's mgh. Where that h is the distance above the gravitational datum. So that h can be negative. In fact, we'll hopefully get to a system where it is negative in a little bit. Okay. What's actually a good choice of a gravitational datum for this system? Yeah, the equilibrium length. Right? Then my gravitational potential just becomes mgx. Because right? X is the displacement away from my gravitational datum. Yes, sir?
You can't be below the datum?
Yes, you can. Right? So you could pick a datum. Just in that case, H is negative. You have negative gravitational potential because you have less gravitational potential than you did at your datum. So you can make that choice, just like picking the right frame, particularly if you get to 3D, can really simplify the math part of a problem. Moving that guy around can do the same. Okay? What's spring potential energy? It's 1/2. It probably has a K, since K's our spring. X squared, what is it in general case?
Delta squared.
Where delta is that displacement from the spring's equilibrium length. So for this particular system, yeah, that's going to be X. Okay. This stuff sounds a little bit familiar, hopefully. Okay, good. Reason we're talking about energy is we're going to talk about a method for modeling systems that utilizes the energy rather than looking directly at the forces and mass and inertia properties. Okay? And that Lagrange's equation of motion, Lagrange's method, you probably have it more generally called. Lagrange's method is what we would call an analytical solution to equations of motion. It's not dealing directly with the forces. Okay. It's going to use energies to help us get to equations of motion. Okay. These analytical methods, of which Lagrange is one and probably the most famous, are going to allow us to ignore reaction forces if we want to. Internal reaction forces. And that's one of their big strengths, these methods. Okay. And we're going to base these equations of motion, we're going to talk about generalized coordinates, which is basically the degrees of freedom of our system. We get to choose those, like we talked about, choosing your coordinates to describe your system. And we're going to talk eventually about this idea called virtual displacements and virtual warp that help formulate these formulations. Okay. Let's do a quick little review, maybe. Okay, I have a bar of length, let's say it's 2L long, has mass M, and it's attached to ground We have these two springs. We're going to leave them equal for right now. Okay, and confined to this plane. Plane of the board. How many degrees of freedom?
2.
Everybody agree with 2? Yes? No? Okay. I'm going to agree with 2. 2 degrees of freedom means I'm going to have 2 equations of motion that describe this system. It also means I need 2 generalized coordinates, to use the kind of Lagrangian terminology, to describe this system. And we're going to see those written as Q. Some vector Q contains those. So if I'm going to pick some kind of variable to describe this system, it's 2 degrees of freedom, what should I pick? Can I pick? So yeah, maybe I can pick some kind of rotation. And maybe there's some kind of height of the center of mass. So I could use, hey, x and theta is one choice. And where x is, again, the height of the center of mass. Theta is the pitch angle of this thing.
You're saying the k's are equivalent to?
I have. It doesn't matter in this case, though. We're just talking about what coordinates. What else could I use? What are some other choices?
Two x's.
Two x's. So I could pick kind of 2 points on this, and I might maybe pick, let's say, x1. X1, x2. That might be a good choice. Maybe I can measure these distances really easily. I can measure those 2 endpoint heights easily. So I can deal directly with x1 and x2. That gives me everything I need to know about the system as well. And again, I'm just making the point, trying to make it explicit. You get to make that choice. Okay? But you have to have the number of generalized coordinates as degrees of freedom for the type of systems you're dealing in here. Come to grad dynamics, you get more than that. Start dealing with constraints and such. Okay. So, generalized coordinates. We're going to define L. L is going to be defined as kinetic energy, total system kinetic energy, minus the total system potential energy. That L is for Lagrangian. Kinetic minus potential. We're going to start out with a simple form of this Lagrangian equation. We're going to say, well, hey, I can write equations of motion, and I'll explain the terms in just a second. Solving that is going to give us our equations of motion of the system, where I basically iterates over the generalized coordinates. So I have to solve this. In our case, over here, we have to solve this equation for x, and then we have to solve the equation for theta. Okay. These are partial derivatives. In this case, a partial derivative with respect to the velocity of that first generalized coordinate, or that generalized coordinate. And then in the second occasion, I have the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to the generalized coordinate itself. The first term gets a total time derivative out front. Okay. This is the form. We're going to be adding some more terms over the next couple lectures. Haven't thought about how damping might fit into this at all yet. And we're not talking yet about including non-conservative external forces. So this is basically our spring bouncing up and down, our pendulum in free vibration without any damage, this version of the equation. Okay, so let's do an example with this. Let's go back to moving horizontally. Okay, so our mass M touched the ground with a spring constant K, no friction between the mass and ground. Okay, we've already done equations of motion of this guy using Newton-Euler. Let's do it with Lagrange. I'm going to solve this system with Lagrange. I need to figure out, what's my first step? I should still draw a free body diagram. And I'll do that quickly. Save us a minute. Here we go. I should also still explicitly define what my coordinates are. And I'm going to have a fixed frame over here somewhere, but define my coordinate x to be in the capital I direction. And x defined from the point where this system's at equilibrium. So when x is 0, that spring is at its equilibrium length. Common assumptions we're going to make throughout the semester. Okay. So take care of that preliminary work, whether you're going to do Newton-Euler or Lagrange. Right. Then we need to figure out, if we're using Lagrange, what's the total kinetic energy of this system? Okay. So in this case, we have just kind of a point mass, pure linear motion. Right? And we're not going to let it move up and down. Right? So we got 1 degree of freedom motion, back and forth. What describes the total kinetic energy? There's a 1/2, and I heard an m. What else? X dot squared. So the velocity of this guy is x dot, and we square it. So there's our total kinetic energy. Okay. What kind of potential do we have here? Just the spring potential, right? And this is a place where, hey, that, like I said, this datum wherever I want, it has gravitational potential still, right? So if I set my datum right where it's at, it's always zero. It's not moving ever. I can just ignore it. It's not contributing anything to the motion of the system. Okay. So we have the spring. What's the spring potential? 1/2 kx squared. Right. Our delta in this case, because we said the spring was at its equilibrium length when x is 0, that delta is just x. All right, so our Lagrangian then is t minus v. All right. Bundled in this, we've made a choice, kind of, already, that, hey, our generalized coordinate in this case is x. There's not a whole lot else that makes a lot of sense in this problem, actually, right? So now I have my Lagrangian. I actually need to plug in and solve this guy. Okay, for we have one equation, right? We have 1 degree of freedom. We have one equation. Right? We can write the Lagrange. Equation becomes that. And the way I work this, and maybe recommend you do, is I just kind of work each term individually and then smash them back together, rather than trying to do it all at one equation. So let's do that. What's the partial of Lagrangian with respect to x dot? Mx dot. Okay. What's the total time derivative of that term? Mx double dot, assuming our mass is constant, of course, which we generally will. Okay. So now we have our kind of first term on this guy. Right. Second term, what's the partial Lagrangian with respect to x, minus kx. We're done. We have minus, minus gives us a plus. Equation of motion for our mass spring system. It's Lagrange's method. Should notice it's the same we got with Newton-Euler. Right? It better be. Right? It's a property of the system. Okay. Let's try another simple example to help. We can move back over here. Actually, before we move on, questions about that one, before we move on. Okay. Let's do another example using Lagrange. Another very simple example. Okay. Okay, so we have point mass M at the end of a massless, inextensible, inflexible rod, L. Its angle from horizontal described by theta. And we have gravity acting on this system. Okay, pure, kind of perfect pen at the joint there. I'm going to get the equation of motion of this, and we're going to use Lagrange. We already did this once, but where do I start? Pre-bi-diagram. What kind of forces do we have? That's some reactions at the pen. What else do we have? Gravity, and it acts on the mass. What's my next step? Some kind of coordinate system. I'm going to pick one here. The origin at the pen. Looks like that. And we can call, let's give that pen point a name. We'll call him O for the origin of that system. All right. So this is how I would recommend starting any problem, whether you're going to do Lagrange or Newton-Euler. Draw your free body diagram, figure out coordinate systems. It's going to help you either way. At this point, you know, this system, you go either way. It's pretty simple, either method. But this is the place where I think drawing these things will also help you see which one of these methods is going to be the easier path to go down. In this case, I'm prescribing let's do it Lagrange, so let's do it Lagrange. What's my next step for Lagrange? Finding some energies. Well, this is kind of a half step before that. I have to figure out what are my generalized coordinates? What should I use in my generalized coordinates? Because in Lagrange, I have to describe those energies in terms of the generalized coordinates. So kind of implicit, you know, we did it a little bit over there. In figuring out the kinetic energy is first figuring out what my generalized coordinates need to be. What's the kind of obvious choice here? Theta. So I'm going to say, hey, my generalized coordinate is just theta. Why couldn't I use like x and y location of the point mass? I could. Yes, I can. Why is it not a good choice? Yeah, so there I have 1 degree of freedom system. If I'm going to use 2 generalized coordinates to describe it, I also have to include information about the constraint that links those two guys together. Okay, that's a pain in the butt. So when you can, pick a number of generalized coordinates equal to your degrees of freedom. You get to ignore constraint forces and things like that when you do that. All right? Okay, so in this case, I'm going to do Lagrangian. I'm going to write my kinetic energy of this system. What is it? Okay, maybe we don't know. Let's look at, I can do this. Well, what's the velocity of this mass? Right? Or, right? L in the theta dot direction always, it's just pure rotation, just polar coordinates. Okay? Or I maybe can remember, there's a version of this kinetic energy stuff for systems in pure rotation. What's that? The form kind of matches our linear version. Yeah, I omega squared is probably how you learned it. Remember that that moment of inertia is always about some point? In this case, that's going to be O. And then omega is our angular velocity of the system. This works in pure rotation. If I have pure rotation, I can get away with just that term. And our system's in pure rotation right now. What's the omega? Yeah, it's theta dot for us right now. For this system. If I have a rigid body that's not in pure rotation, if it's translating and rotating at the same time, you have to include linear and rotation. And generally, the easiest way to do that is about center of mass. Moment of inertia. And then angular velocity about center mass. So there we have our kinetic energy. What's I? What's the moment of inertia of a point mass at a distance L? ML squared. So however we decided to look at this one, we've got the same thing. Which is a good check that we got it right. Okay. What other source of potential energy do we have here? Or what source of potential energy? Sorry. Just gravity. It's the only source of potential here. Okay. Embedded in, trying to figure out what the potential energy from gravity is a choice of where my datum should be. What's a good choice here? Okay. So we have one vote for picking out, hey, kind of the bottom of this guy as datum. I'm going to vote for picking that guy. That's the one I'm going to pick. And I'm going to pick that one because it's easier to describe, it's easier to kind of stay on the system and describe that one, if you will. This is a good check as you're working problems and practicing this. Solve this both ways. You better get the same thing at the end. Okay? Good check as you're working through modeling problems. I'm never going to dictate to you guys you have to use Newton-Euler or you have to use Lagrange. Solve it both ways. See which one's easier. That's how you're going to develop some intuition about which way you should go. So if I pick up here at point O as the gravity datum, we know there's some mg there. What's the h? Yeah, we know that that distance, the mass now is below the gravitational datum, so we got a minus sign. And that height below the datum, cosine theta. So then our Lagrangian is that. Okay. For our system, we have 1 degree of freedom. It's just theta. And no non-conservative external forces. So the right-hand side is zero. So let's work through this guy. Okay, the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to theta dot is what? ML squared. Almost. There's one more term. Theta dot. There you go. Okay. Total time derivative of that. Like we said, kind of L is fixed and M's not changing. So those terms are fixed. The only guy changing is that. Okay. What is the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to theta? There we go. And now we have all the terms we need to form our equation of motion. Question? So we get the equation of motion for a pendulum, which we better because this is a pendulum. And these steps for Lagrange are basically the same, no matter how complex your system is. Figure out the energies. And then for each of your generalized coordinates, you have to solve this guy. Questions about that? Starting out Lagrange method. How many of you have seen Lagrange's method before? Anybody? A few folks? Okay. This is going to be, haven't seen it yet. These simple problems, you don't, why would I do this instead of Newton-Euler probably? Right. What comes in is that, hey, it's going to let me, on more complex systems, not have to worry about reaction forces. Whereas Newton-Euler, you always have to include those. So that can save us a lot of work down the line. On Tuesday, we'll continue working a less simple example of using both Newton-Euler and Lagrange, and then continue working through our modeling of Chapter 1 moving forward. Make sure you get me prereq forms by 5 p.m. tomorrow if you haven't already.